Well, hello and welcome to Tom Deacon Deconstructs, the podcast where I aim to delve that little bit deeper with my guests to find out what motivates them, what drives them, and what gives them the passion for the thing that they do. It's the third in the series. There's two prior episodes to this, obviously. One is Eddie Brimson, who is a fantastic performer, stand-up comedian, writer, who's written some brilliant football books, delving into the unsavory side of football. And then there's also Ryan O'Reilly, a singer-songwriter, talking about his first ever EP. Both well worth a listen, and I really appreciate all the comments I've been receiving and everyone who's been subscribing so they don't miss an episode. If you haven't done so, then make sure you do that when you get a chance. I'd really appreciate that. So let's get to today's show. The featured guest is Gordon Strachan. I have his book in front of me right now. It's called My Life in Football. It's a frank and often wry take on British football. That's a quote from the Glasgow Herald. For those of you who don't know who Gordon Strachan is, he's had one of the most illustrious careers in modern football. As a player, he was the heartbeat of Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen in the early 1980s, before being signed by Ron Atkinson to play for Manchester United. He captained Leeds to championships in the early 1990s, won 50 Scottish caps, and went on to manage Coventry, Southampton, Middlesbrough, Celtic, and the Scotland national team. A former regular on Match of the Day and one of the most honest and interesting voices in the game. He was also awarded the OBE for services to football north and south of the border in 1993. A fantastic guest who really opens up about what it's like to be a football manager, the highs and lows, talking about how you inspire people, how you motivate people, and most of all, importantly, how you need to have fun whilst doing it. Really open and honest conversation. I know that you're going to enjoy it. And also, I wanted to find out what it was like to be managed by him. So after working with him recently for Southampton Football Club, for those of you who don't know, I do the match day hosting with a fabulous team. And I got to work with James Beattie, and he talked so warmly about Gordon Strachan, and I thought he would be the ideal candidate to talk about him. So I chat to him. For those of you who don't know who James Beattie is, James started his career at Blackburn, came to Southampton, was managed by Gordon Strachan, went to the FA Cup final in 2003, moved on to Everton, to Rangers, to Stoke, Accrington, where he later became a manager. So listen, he'll be on the podcast as well, giving his insight into potentially what he learned from Gordon Strachan as a manager. So that's all to come in the podcast. Interestingly enough, for this episode today, I conduct the interviews via Zoom. And Gordon was insistent that we be able to see each other, which was fascinating because I hadn't really prepped the spare room that I'm in where I've got my setup. And he was in his office, and I asked him about various things that were in the background that I could see. So I do apologize because you can't see them, but he had a whole framework behind him. And he also started with an absolute pearl of wisdom to begin with about people in general.
That's what you can do. We're the same with academy kids. We're the football academy. You can only offer them your advice. You don't want to take it. It's like that in anything in life, Tom. You can only offer it. You kind of drag them to the... But there you go. That's life.
I'm loving the setup there. It's brilliant. You've got everything there. Just behind you.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have no football memorabilia in the house apart from maybe... The rest of it's all family, and I don't have any football memorabilia, strips or trophies or medals about the house, that's for sure. That's it, really. That's me and Leslie. These two guys there, I'm still friends with them, but I lived in Diggs with them when I was 15 in Dundee. And that's the coaching staff at Celtic where I had there. So that's really it. And this is just my office that I do my stuff in.
Well, that's great to know that you're going to be in your office throughout this interview, Gordon. I want to start, if I may, with Strachan, My Life in Football, the book you wrote.
Yeah, because I wrote the first chapter myself, and then I got the Celtic job, really. The first chapter was mine. I was quite happy with it. And it was quite honest to start with in the first chapter. When you look at it, you went, yeah, it's honest, but that's the way I felt, so... It's now funny enough, people are talking about experience lockdown at the moment. We're very lucky where we stay. When people phone me, I just go, well, I've kind of went through this about twice. It's like when you get the sack, you just want to keep your head down and keep it out of the way. So I've practiced for this moment. I've had a bit of practice, so I'm okay.
Because that moment in the book, Gordon, it's called The Pressure Game. I think it just sums up everything. You're there, you've left Coventry, and you went and tried your hand at parasailing. So you and your wife, Leslie, yeah, go and do it. It's not your normal comfort zone to do that.
No, I'm scared of the heights anyway. Yeah.
But you went up, and that feeling, I've done it myself, you do feel weightless. And it's brilliant. So all of the stresses you had at Coventry, the highs and lows, the things that the fans don't see, the work that you're tirelessly putting in, the mental strain that has on you, and you get that feeling of being weightless. Did it put everything in perspective in that moment?
I think the way I looked at it is that it's the first time I've really failed. At the time I thought I failed, but when I look back, I thought, no, I was there for 6 years. Player coach, player manager. And then we had a right good team. And then I should have moved. I thought I should have moved, but people convinced me to stay on. So you feel you feel you let people down, you know, especially the chairman and people who were close to me at that point, your family, and you're a bit embarrassed. And I said to the chairman when he said, what had they call it a day? And he was emotional at the time. He was in tears sacking me on the Sunday. I said, can you do me a favour? I said, what's that? I said, keep this to yourself till tomorrow morning, because I just want to get out of town. I don't want to speak to anybody. So I left Coventry at 4:30 the next again morning, and I drove to Scotland. And but then went, and I said, the funny thing, it was September 11th was next again day, that day, next again day. So I got caught up in this. But when I went to Tenerife, when I was walking about the first couple of days, I couldn't look at anybody. My head was done. Don't speak to me about football. Don't patronise me. Don't say anything to me. Blah, blah. I just don't want to meet anybody. But when we went in this paragliding thing, me and Leslie went up, and I'm scared of the heights. But it was the first time since I got the sack in 3 days that I felt comfortable, because nobody could speak to me apart from Leslie. And I didn't even want to come down. I just wanted to stay up there. I'll just pay you to drive, fly, just keep going around the island, pal. Do us a favour. So when I was coming down, there's people in the boat, you know, and you think, they're going to speak to me again. So I would prefer to have stayed up there all day.
But that feeling, that sensation you had at Coventry, and I think this is what the podcast is about, when you look back reflectively on things, you're able to say now, at the time, you felt distraught. And you didn't want to talk to people about it, but now you're able to look back. But that feeling, it went away. You were able to talk normally. You didn't need to be high up in the air again.
Yeah, well, you talk about how far you can go in terms of depression. So, as again, we have to watch out with depression, because I was depressed. I didn't suffer from depression. It's a completely different thing. So we need to watch sometimes that you get people who are depressed, hijack depression. I've got an idea what the different situational depression is, what I had. The situation's made me depressed. When I got another club and started winning, it goes away. Time will take it away. It's different, you know. So there's many times where I've had situational depression where you know you're depressed because of a certain thing. So once I got gradually feeling better, then I started looking at myself, and when I got another club, life becomes better. So it's like that in the football management, where you get this, after you get beaten a Saturday, you're low, you want to pack it in, you hate the game. Monday, as soon as you first hit, bang, we're away again, you know. So, but when I look back now, you think, well, player manager, player coach, player manager, because at the time you just think, relegation sack. And you think, well, people kind of condense your career in that the 3 games at the end of the season where you got beaten, they get the sack. And then you look back and think, no, I'm quite proud of what I did there. But at the time, it was crushing.
Yeah, I imagine lots of people who would be listening will think, it doesn't sound much fun being a manager. So what kept you, that is it the competitiveness of you?
No, it's not competitive, no. I love seeing people getting better. And I like helping people getting better at what they do, or a group of, but also love the football world. I think the football world has so many great people in it. And it's the only job in the world where you can actually be in it. And when you're 65, you can still act like you're 16 or 17. There's no age barriers to the humour, whatever you want to call it, the camaraderie. I just love being around football people. I love working with people. And when I got into management and coach, I just love making people better. And then you get this wonderful glowy satisfaction when you come in a dressing room after the game and you stand back and you see everybody celebrating, whether it be Celtic, Scotland, Coventry. And you get this glow of, oh, I helped to make that happen. So they're getting a wee bit of what I had as a football player, and I don't know how special it was when you won games, enjoy games, you're achieving things, but as a manager you sit back and just go, that was good, I'm enjoying watching these guys enjoying themselves. That meant everybody, you know, it wasn't just the players, it meant the backroom staff, the coaching staff, the people that helped us, the cleaning woman, the laundry woman, all them celebrating. So you just get this glow of satisfaction, you've made people happy.
But I guess the problem there is then when it's not happening, you take it personally. You're
in a big way.
And the fact that, I mean, it's written everywhere about yourself. You have a great sense of humour, and if there's no sense of humour, I suppose people know that the results aren't happening. And then I guess that doubt comes into you because you want to improve people, but when it's not working, you take that personally, I think.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with self-doubt. There's a couple of things that keeps me going. I always had self-doubt. People used to think, oh, he's confident playing it. Nope, every time I played a game of football, I always thought the person who was playing against or the group of players could be better than me. So it was like a kind of safety valve that if I ever thought that I was very good at what I did, if I ever thought that the people I was playing against weren't very good, that's danger to me. So I always had this sense of insecurity about what I did. But when I went on and I started playing, I felt as confident as anybody. But before the games or before any big match, I always felt like that. So, and self-doubt, you get that, I don't know, of it in your game, where you sit back and say, where am I going? What am I doing? Am I wasting my time here? But you just keep plugging on. And every knockback you get, it's called character building. And you have to come through that. I think kids and young people nowadays are trying to get through to a career without character building. You have to have it, because there'll be many times, whatever business you are, you'll come and get situations that are hard, it's hard to deal with. But if you've not had character building moments, you will not be able to deal with it. It's like when you get the Scotland thing. I've had so many, and before even Celtic, they had so many character building moments that, trust me, it's no easy. The pain is still there, the depression is still there. But the fact is, you know, that I can come through this, you know. It's always in the back of your mind you can come through it. So you need that character building stuff. And I was speaking to people the other day, the young kids that I'm speaking to on the Zoom stuff, about character. I take Chris Kamara and Vinnie Jones, for example. I played with them at Leeds. They weren't the great footballers. They're fantastic characters. And they gave everything. Every training session, they drag people on to make them feel better, made them fitter. They had great sense of humour. They had great camaraderie. They had humility. They looked after people. So when they finished their footballing career, when Cammy's not got anything to do and Vinny's not got much to do, one goes into films and makes 60 films. They're not that great, but the fact is, he knows that if he gets a knockback at an audition, he goes again. He goes again. The same with Chris Kamara. The game's finished. He never had enough money to retire. He goes into TV and he gets a knockback, and people will say this and that, and he just keeps going. So you need these character building moments to allow you to be a character. And trust me, if you're not a character, when you go on a football field with 100,000 people there, you will just crumble. Yeah. Because it doesn't matter how many tweeting followers you've got or Instagram, you're on your own. You're just your teammates out there. And sometimes you're on your own because you're having such a bad day that the boys are trying to help you, but you have to dig yourself out of this.
So I guess reading the book, I've got it in front of me here, that first, for you as a manager at Coventry, that was your first character test. Once you'd got rid of that.
As a manager. Yeah. So I've been testing my character from 11-year-old. 11-year-old.
But as a manager, you then were able to learn from that and go, okay, because it's even in the book that you talk about being a bit of a warrior, and every true warrior needs to put down the sword eventually and know when that time is.
Yeah.
But you went on to Southampton, you learned from that, you had knockbacks, but then you move on to the next club and you kept learning. So I suppose it's if you'd have said that's enough at after Coventry, you know, you wouldn't have built that character as a manager.
Well, I mean, again, when you go to Southampton, at the first 5 or 6 weeks, I was saying to myself, what have I done? I mean, here I go again. What have I done? You're off your head. Why are you doing this to yourself? Why are you having sleepless nights? Why are you speaking to people? Why are you doing this? And then you get a couple of wins, you go, that's why. Everybody's celebrating. We've got the table. Life's good. And family are happy. It's a strange profession. But as I said to you, the glow of satisfaction when you, and even now, not talking about trophies financially, it's a number of ex-players who phone you up and say, can I get a bit of advice here? And you keep that contact with them. And some of them have had real good stand-up arguments with them. But we still keep in contact. And as I, early 60s, it's that is kind of, that is a reward for doing the football management as well. Keeping in contact with these great people.
I do want to talk about the fact I caught up with James Beattie, and I've got a few things to run past you. It's all complimentary though, Gordon, don't worry. But in terms of building a team, all right, I wanted to establish this. I don't know if you've seen it, The Last Dance. It's with Michael Jordan. It's on Netflix at the moment.
I've watched the first episode.
And that's it? You're not going to watch any more?
I'll watch more, watch more.
Because essentially what's throughout that documentary and why it's so brilliant is you understand Michael Jordan, he even says there's a price to winning, there's a price to leadership. And sometimes great leaders fail because they worry about people's feelings. I don't think what I'm getting from you, that the sense that you weren't afraid to challenge people's feelings at times, but in terms of being a leader, that's what you were in your managerial career.
Yeah, but it had consequences, the challenging people, because you had the mental scars of saying, how damaging am I pushing this fella too far? You know, you don't walk away from it and think, who cares? There's consequences to telling people the truth, what you think the truth is, or what you think's the best for them. It's not like you're going face-to-face with someone and say, listen, your career's, you need to do this, you need to do that, and da-da-da, and you have to tell them the truth. And you have to tell some of the older players who have maybe passed a bit, you have to tell them the truth. I had to leave Steve Agruzovic out the team, who's, it's arguable that he's been Coventry's best ever footballer, right? And I had to leave him out the team when he was 40, because I thought it was the right reason. And I never slept a night before. I couldn't eat in the morning to tell this great character that I was going to leave him out the team. So it has consequences. Everything you do has consequences. But if you're doing it for the greater good, then you have to deal with it. And funny enough, at the time, the players probably dislike you immensely for whatever reason. But it's funny, a number of players who are now coming up to me later on and saying, listen, I apologise for my behaviour. I've just realised now what you're trying to do for me or push me or whatever. And Steve Agruzovic, I play golf with Steve Agruzovic. But at the time, it was a horrendous thing to do, but it needed to be done. But it has its consequences, you know, when people say that you face problems head on. And you can only do that when you're hungry and determined and competitive. Near the end of my career, that's why I stopped at Middlesbrough. I didn't have that I would put problems to the side and maybe do it. Whereas when I was younger, right, I need to sort it out now. I was putting them aside and then I was neglecting my duty of being truthful to the players. So that's when I knew that full-time management was probably enough for me then.
Taking on board those challenges, I was going to mention that the book doesn't have Middlesbrough or the end of your Celtic time or the national team or technical director at Dundee. That moment that you realised for Middlesbrough, I've done enough, that was that simple reason that you just weren't being the manager that you knew in your heart that you needed to be.
I wasn't being the manager they needed at the time. And saying that, I think there's a couple of relegation teams who especially go down with big money players I think Sunderland, a lot of clubs like that, I've realised, I think it's a 2 or 3 manager job before they get back again, because you really need to weed out the guys on 3 or 4 year contracts who are actually stronger than you at the moment with unbelievable wages, but don't really care about winning. So I think what you look at, the good thing about that is I can walk away from that and go, right, that was my fault. I can't blame anybody else. I think when you walk away for the job, if you think, oh, he didn't help me either. Steve Gibson was great. The people around about him were great. It was my management in terms of recruitment. And I'm not saying the guys that I brought in weren't the good players, but it just wasn't their time to be at that club. So life's easier when you walk away and think, well, that was my fault, really.
That idea of letting go, I guess, is frequent.
Well, the funny thing is that if you go away blaming people, this one, that one, he didn't help me there, that, it lingers with you. Well, at least me and Middlesbrough went, bang, sorry, my fault, see you later, call it a day, yeah, that's fine.
Talking of motivating people, you as a manager, getting the best out of your players, I want to know what it is that you looked for in players. There's a tool in the toolbox where you can motivate someone, but it's powerful, but it's yet unsustainable for a long period of time. There's that love, fear, hate, that if you can get a player to come out of their shell, or you can inspire them. What was your philosophy for those?
Well, I like people to start with. I like integrating with people, and I like being liked. So it's not always achievable, that. But that's the way I go about it. But also, no matter where I've been, it's good people, working with good people. And it's finding out as quickly as possible who are the ones that are going to hold you back. I was using the Scotland team because if you didn't fancy him as a personality, he just went, I'm not picking you again. It's different if it's different. We've got 3 or 4 year contracts. How do you work that one out? But you always give players a chance because I've always been good with people, I think. Speaking to people, after a week or two, I've got an idea who they are. And you might be wrong at times, so you've got to give them a bit of a chance. And you give that people that chance. If they don't take it, then somehow you've got to move on and we call it a day.
But in terms of getting the team as a manager...
Thing, going back to that motivation thing, there's no... Yeah. Everybody thinks it's some sort of Churchillian speech you make every to a group or a player. You inspire people every day, every moment, every minute. Your body language has been watched and contact with players. I might be walking down the tunnel and going, glad you're in my team, and just walk away and say nothing else. You know, so there's all, it's timing, it's understanding the moment, is it the moment, when do you speak to them, when do you talk to them? It's like Sir Alex. He could be a right bully at times, but he had that wee bit that made you feel. But he was a wee bit different. He turned us into maniacs, Sir Alex. He brought the devil out in you, and I was just trying to bring out the competitive spirit with most players and bring out everything they had, every piece of ability. But also going along with that at the same time, the motivational stuff and all that. They had to work hard. We had to get them fitter. And because that gives you a mental strength, being fitter. The fitter you become, the more mentally strong you become, the sharper you become, your concentration stays with you longer. And it's funny because when you get fitter, the brain goes, yeah, I like this. I'm pushing you on, because the brain's getting more competitive. Right, we'll go, we'll get fitter. And it's just like a cycle, keeps pushing you on. So in between that and looking after players and make sure you look after them, because there were some times when you had interviews and you'd have to make yourself look silly, or you make yourself look sarcastic, or make yourself look aggressive, because you're trying to defend your players. No matter what anybody was saying about your players, you had to look after them. I got in most of my scrapes after match interviews. But my job was to protect the players at all time. And if I had anything to say about them, then we'd say it in private.
When you talked about the inspiration there, you feel inspired when you feel like a love and ownership of something. It's in the book. I didn't want to bring it up or discuss it because it's in the book, you and Sir Alex. But interestingly enough, you knew what you needed from a manager. You definitely talked about that as a player in the book. And he got the best out of people. But sometimes you wanted that the arm around the shoulder to sort of say, you know, give you that respect a little bit.
I got it now and then, yeah. Once or twice over the 9 years we worked. So I was okay with it, the relationship. Seriously okay. I have no problems. We used to laugh and joke together. Matter of fact, we do that now. We used to laugh and joke together. So it wasn't a problem. At times you'd want to, you know, but people talk, this thing about losing the dressing room. I mean, I kid you not, Sixers wanted to kill him every Monday morning. You know, two or three in particular. Tuesday, we're off again. We're all going in one direction. So that losing the dressing room, if it's a good bunch of lads, you'll never lose the dressing room. You'll get angry at times. We spoke about earlier on where loads of guys like Richard Shaw, Williams, Dion Dublin, all these guys, we've had face-to-face arguments. But mates, you know.
But in terms of, is no one's questioning Sir Alex as a manager, but what you said there about you needed to motivate people and knowing the right time to
get in my way. Makes me maybe be a sense of humour and maybe going out my way to help them and doing something or turn up their house or speak to them when they don't expect. I turn up, I'll go and drive, he's out, but I'll go and speak to his missus just to make sure that she's all right. So there's all different ways of looking after people. Make look at, we babysat, me and my wife, for some of the players at Coventry when they come up here when they were abroad. So, and I brought players into my house to make sure that they got looked after and stayed with us for weeks or days or whatever it is. So there's all different ways of doing it. But whatever you do as a manager, it has to be you and your personality. We're all kind of different. We're stubborn. Most managers are stubborn. But people think that is a bad trait. It's no, it's a good trait. Now and then it will get you in trouble. But overall, if you're not stubborn, you'll never stick to your principles, your morals, everything about what you think's right in the game or what you think's right about how a person should live. Occasionally, you will be wrong. I'm afraid that's the way it goes with stubbornness. Sir Alex, everybody's got it. But if that stubbornness makes you successful most of the time, then it's worth it.
You talk about the management. It is all-consuming. It becomes your job as a manager. You talked about it there. You're babysitting funny, other players.
Wasn't it all-consuming for me? I had a routine, one or two routines that took me away from the madness. One, I used to, at Celtic, I used to learn Spanish every night for an hour. So I put the headphones on, learn Spanish. It would just take my mind away. And at Celtic, we used to go away on a Wednesday and go to a place called Aran Mór and used to go and watch a play, a pie and a pint. And you watch a play, you got a pie and a pint. I got a cup of tea instead of a pint. And cinema used to be every Thursday night. So I had, and also Leslie come everywhere, you know Leslie. She come everywhere with me to watch games of football. So I kept things that were real to me and the family, rather than just go, right, I'm a football manager, see you later. See you in about 15 years. I never done it that way. I could always manage to I had these get out clauses that helped keep me sane.
But even in the book, there's a lovely line, finding that balance, and you're talking about your get out clauses, you call them, but yeah. There's even a bit in the book which says, there's a sign you had in the kitchen, I think, or it said, we interrupt this marriage to bring you the football season.
Still got it. Yeah, it's still there. Well, that was Leslie's sense of humour. And it is, as I say, you've got the get-out clauses, but that was mostly for Leslie and everybody, because wherever I was, the football was still in my head, if you know what I mean. I'd be watching a player pie and a pint going, I need to speak to him tomorrow morning. I need to tell him his throat, you know. I'd be watching fantastic actors, but going, oh, I need to speak to him. Oh, jeez, what am I playing on Saturday? Oh, we're playing Rangers. Who am I going to pick? So
you said it wasn't all-consuming, but it is.
The only time it really lost it was the Spanish lessons, or maybe a real good film. If a film was good, I lose myself in that. Or a real good, but if it wasn't great, I'd, but I'm talking about at night. The last thing at night, you're oh, who am I? And the first thing in the morning, bang, you're thinking about football again. You're not thinking about how long you slept, but it's like, let's think football. So
what more can they do? But it seems like from you, there isn't much more you can do. It seeps its way into the fabric of your everyday life. Therefore, you're never switching it off.
Yeah, because you're responsible, like anything. You're responsible for a lot of people and fans. And this is Celtic. I don't know how many fans have got around the world. It's millions and millions and millions. You're responsible for that. And you're the Scotland manager, you're responsible for that as well. And it's Coventry, where there are 25,000 fans or half a million is put around. You're responsible for their... You have a chance to make these people happy every week. And when it doesn't... If it doesn't, you think the other way, I've just killed everybody's, and the players, I'm just disappointing people again. And it sticks with you.
Do you think you would have been good as, I don't know, a business manager or another manager in some respect, if there wasn't football in your life?
Probably, because I get on with people. And you don't have to be brilliant, but getting on with people is a big thing in life. People take it for granted. No, it's no. You can bring people together. You can work with them. You can make them work harder. So, I enjoy people. It's not like I don't enjoy. I enjoy meeting people all the time.
So, with the podcast, I try to find out about people, what motivates them. For you, it's people then, seeing them develop, grow, getting the best from them.
And I obviously, I like the competition. I like... When I played football, I liked the competition. But I never use this. And it's funny because when I Ken Dalglish and I play a lot of golf together. We live in the same kind of area. And he never actually tells he's won anything. Never. Never. And I thought about this 20 years ago. When I first really got close to him, I thought, yeah. Because everybody goes on about, the guys that win the League Cup in 1971 or something like that and go, I'm a winner. That's all they've won. You go, no, really, I played against you and beat you 6-9 with my team, so you can't be a winner all the time. I think all you can do in life, even in your game, is compete and have no regrets once you finish whatever you've done. Whether it's us today, you've done your homework, that's good, so you can set this up. Brilliant. If it doesn't work, then it's not been your fault, it's been my fault, because you've done your research, all the rest of it and that kind of stuff. It's like me as a football player, if I prepared right, I did that right, trained right, ate right, slept right, and I played and I got beat. Well, it's just because the other team were better, or the guy was better. So I'm okay that way. I like competing. I don't have to win all the time. I like to win, but I'm okay if I've competed.
So no more management now?
No.
So what motivates you now then, Gordon?
Well, I've got something new now. I want to produce... Well, I've got two things. We've got the Football Foundation, which is to produce young men and make better men, which can come on. But the academy stuff, I've been big into academy football for 15 years, especially looking at Scottish players and whatever. So I'm big into that. And I went around the world speaking to coaches, not copying anything, speaking to them. And I found out that every academy has different problems, where they have no money, loads of money. There's everybody in different cultures, different this, that, and everything. So I try to get all my ideas that I think were right for Scottish football. I can put Dundee have allowed to give me a blank canvas to get on with. I got for the same thing on one side of the world and another side of the world, the blank canvas. The fact is, Leslie would have to move, and me and her would be on our own, and I'd be away, and she'd be on her own. The fact is, we go back to Dundee. Family's there, brother's there, dad, we know people there. That's where I started. And we can still have this family thing and work at the academy. That's why I'm there. And I'm enjoying working with the coaches, because that's what I do. I'm a real technical director, because technical director comes in many forms. I'm a technical, what do you do? I go scouting. I do the wages. I do the salaries. Mine's just technical. And it's all, how do we get the best of the young players? And how do we get the best at the coaches? I work with all the coaches through all levels. And I'm there for the manager if he needs me every now and then. I'm more like a sports psychologist for him. I've seen about 4 training sessions in the first team. And it's because I love it. I was meant to only go there for maybe 8 to 10 days, but I've ended up there 3 weeks a month instead of 8 or 10 days. So I'm still in the game, but I don't have to deal with the nonsense of the game.
It was a question I wanted to ask you. In terms of management, people think they could always do a better job.
Absolutely. too. It's the same at the moment now with Boris and the cabinet. Everybody say, oh, why didn't you do it then? Why did you do it then? Why do we do that? Why are we not going over there? Why we should do this? Everybody has an opinion. But you know what? Nobody's ever asked you to be the Prime Minister. Nobody's asked you to be in the government. Nobody's asked you your opinion. Why? Because you don't have an opinion, but don't think about you. So everybody has an opinion. And I can understand that because football's brilliant that way. And it's great with punditry because I would have done this after the game. But how do you know that's got to work? The same just now where people say, well, it could have been, we should have done this earlier and we should have done that and we should have had this and we should have been drinking that and we should have been, somebody should have been told about the obesity, somebody should have been talking about this one. Nobody knew, you know. So how do you know that you would have done any better? You know, so it's an opinions game, but the people at the sharp end are the ones who are making, by the way, talking about politics, I make decisions. And it's only about winning games or losing something. I think decisions you have to make in the Prime Minister just now. And people will just throw you back. Well, if you make that decision, so many are going to die. That must be horrendous. How do you get to sleep with that? Man, if I, there's not enough money in the world to make me Prime Minister just now.
Well,
there you go, a political rant there. How do we get onto that?
But the opinions-based, the world of Twitter and Instagram and all of that social media that, when you were playing, you didn't have to deal with. You just had the newspaper, I guess, and the radio to contend with.
It was easy to deal with that. And people, when I was a manager at Celtic, I never read the paper. I never listened to the radio. I never watched any football programme. I thought Celtic and myself might be on. And that means that I could only deal with reality because that, as you know, that world out there just now, it's a fantasy world. And we know about the fake news. Zuckerberg was on this morning talking about this and all the rest of it. And if you listen to that, you drive yourself crazy. But it's unfortunate that the sports media now are using social media to ask you questions. And they're taking it from social media. But you don't know who these people are. It could be, so it used to be at Celtic. Oh, the fans are saying, which fans? They're on social media on Twitter last night. Well, do you know they're Celtic fans? Well, they're calling themselves... whatever it is, hail, hail, and all the rest of it. Well, that could be another supporter just putting his name to that. So why am I asking? Why am I answering? What do you want to ask me? What have you done? You speak to me as one-to-one. Don't. So I kind of cleared all that out of the way. And also another one, it helped me not to have agendas with newspapers or any media outlet. Because if I didn't read it, I couldn't really get this kind of negativity to any people. And I used to say to our media people, only tell me if it's a lie. Just if whatever you see, if it's conjecture, whatever, if it's a lie, give me a shout. So I kept myself saying that way. And I think a lot of people should think about that, to be honest with you.
Well, it's so hard. It's so hard indeed. Well, listen.
So much good fun with social media, but there's so much nonsense as well.
Well, this is hard facts. This is the truth. James Beattie.
Go on. I wouldn't be so sure about that either.
Okay, Gordon, let me leave you there for 1 second. I want to bring in James Beattie now. James, what was it like having a manager like Gordon and sort of what was his traits that he brought?
I suppose it's different. It's different for me now. Looking back on it, because it's a long time ago, but I still remember this sort of stuff that he'd done. And looking at it from a management coaching point of view now, you fully understand the really good stuff that he'd done. So he had great leadership. I think the players had a respect for his footballing career. And I think his personality that he had as a footballer came out in him as a manager. And it's good. That's a good way because he was tenacious, he was fit, and that's how he wanted his team to play, well organised. But on the other side of it, he had great man management skills as well, because he certainly knew how to get the best out of me as a 23-year-old, still quite a raw footballer, if you know what I mean. I didn't go through any academies or anything like that, so I was still quite raw. But he knew what my strengths were, And whether it was coincidence or not, the team actually played to my strengths. So I think that's one of the reasons attributed to the success that we had as a team and me individually, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was tough. He was not a taskmaster, but if he said do something, you knew you had to do it. And I think he was also good at letting you know where he was in his head, whether you could have a bit of banter with him or whether it was a straight no, you know what I mean? And then he'd always just give you a look or a little comment to let you know that was enough, or, you know what I mean, the line was coming up. It was just great. And he used to join in with the five asides, and he was dead aggressive. I don't know how old he was when he was managing us, but he'd just be exactly the same as when he was playing, you know, dead tenacious, tackling people and that, and leaving a bit on them and that. It was so funny.
Because James, when he came, that was 2001. I've got his book just over there. It's interesting what he says about yourself in his book. But he basically saying you were always you brought an energy. Let's just say that you brought the fun and the banter. That's what Franny Benali, that's what the TIS talks about. But he came in, you'd obviously heard about him as a manager, as a player. Did he live up to what you expected him to be like?
Yeah, his personality was the, and he's famous for his one-liners, shutting people down. But he was like that. But I think what was great as well is the group of lads that we had respected him. And I just think that it's a bit like me now, you know, my personality is, you know, very lively, but I have got a serious side to me. And I suppose that was the same when you were playing, because football was serious. But I always think you've got to play the game with a smile on your face, but there is always time to be serious. And he just knew, I don't know, for me, speaking from a personal point of view, he just knew which buttons to push with me to get me to play and to motivate me, finding them intrinsic motivators that we try and find in players now. He was great. Mm. Cause he knew how to gauge me, whether I needed a stern talking to, or I just needed a, you know, come on beats or whatever. He just knew, he just had it right on. And I think as well, he had good staff around him. I know Gary Pendry used to go with him. So again, understanding why managers take various members of staff with them, because Pendo bounced off him great. And obviously Pendo's a legend up at Blues, and I've seen him on a couple of dinners, end of season dinners and that. And Dennis Rolfe as well was brilliant. And they all sort of just bought into what Gordon was doing. There was a couple of different training methods, you know, to keep things fresh, based on hip mobility, which is it seems to be a little bit of a problem in footballers these days. They've lost a little bit of hip mobility. But training was great, varied, intense. We used to run three or four times a week.
He says it in the book, James. He says that when he first arrives at a club, players would be like, is he really, are we doing this much fitness? But then he would say that the players like yourself would notice the benefit when results would start coming in, or performances individually would improve.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's a footballer's prerogative to mourn, and I probably did my fair share of that myself, but I always knew that I had to probably work twice as hard on things like that, my fitness, because it was such a strength of mine because of my swimming and then obviously the fitness running wise. We were so fit, and like you said there, they always complain, footballers, but it's now I can understand him he was doing the why. So what you just mentioned there is the why are we doing this? It's not a punishment. The why is to get you fitter, to get you stronger, so then you can notice it yourself. Mm. And I think he was one of the first ones that went to the why are we doing it. He didn't need to say it. Like you said, you noticed the improvement in your team performances or your personal performance. Or for me, I used to play 90 minutes, and I swear I could have had a 10-minute break and done 90 minutes again. And I was getting ridiculous distances, some that, you know, they don't even match today.
Yeah.
And because we were so fit. So when you're like that, your fitness is a massive, gives you massive confidence, and you can use it as a weapon. Because we ground, I've always said, we weren't a team of stars, but collectively as a team, we were good. And on some days, we were very good. Yeah, we were poor sometimes, but that's the ups and downs of football. But I know that we got a lot of results in the last 15 minutes or the last 10 minutes or the last 5 minutes because teams couldn't handle us fitness-wise.
Right. Back to you, Gordon.
I asked him about the qualities that you had as a manager. He said the good leadership. And what's really interesting, what he says there is looking back on it, he understands now as someone who's done coaching, managing Accrington, he understands all the things that you were doing. It had a reason, and he understands the great stuff that you were able to do. One thing he does say that you, obviously when it came to five-a-sides, you were dead aggressive, even when you were back at Southampton, and you left some on in the tackles. That's what he said there.
No, he joined in every now and then, because we used to have on a Monday, that was part of our thing, all the coaches used to play the youth team, the youngsters who'd come in. Two reasons why we used to get rid of all our kind of frustrations as coaches, but got to know the young players and what they were like. And James would join in. And I've never kicked anybody in my life, seriously. I was the one in the receiving end all the time. And if I did kick in, it was only because I was tired. Because I unintentionally hurt Alan Shearer one day. But that was just due to tiredness. He was just getting away from it. But I don't know if I've hurt anybody at all.
He was basically saying in the five-a-side, what he was admired most was that you still gave it at the age you were managing.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty pathetic what I was given. But I could see where he's coming from. Yeah, because that's that competitive thing. And even if he got beat, when I got over the fact that I lost, 10 minutes later, I could sit in the glow of being involved in a clash with a cup of tea. And it's like, that was great. I still got beat, but that was great. The competitive side there. And we did have good laughs as well, actually.
Because he said one skill, and I think you've already covered it, but he says you knew how to get the best out of people. So you could identify the strengths. Specifically with James Beattie, you identified his strengths. What was it that you looked for in players? Was it what individual strength they had? Or were you trying to combine or build a team that followed the principles that you wanted them to have?
Yes. So your principles don't change. It's fit. You have to be fit, technically good. So they come together. There's no first or second with that. Being good people, and do you want to learn? So all these things that you put together, I suppose I could find a bit more, but these are the four basic things. And James had that. He was a good person, wanted to get better, wanted to take shortcuts in getting better, but then you had to say, there's no shortcuts to this. Wanted to be shortcuts. So once he found out there was no shortcuts, he ended up playing for England, you know, James. And I've seen players who have more skill than him, no playing for England. But because his determination and his drive, then he got there.
He said that you cared about him, particularly him, and you did of people and the team, and you wanted them to improve. He said he's kind of like a sort of a second dad, he said, and which is lovely to hear, because that means that you, as a manager, you cared about them, you wanted them to succeed. He did say, though, that you would definitely let people know what was on your mind, so that they would know immediately if you were in a mood for banter or you were dead serious. It would take a look, he said.
Yeah, and to be fair, there was that way. And it was not often that way, but there is there is a point where you can have fun with players. But there's a point where they have to know instantly when you're serious here. And I think I got that. But saying that, talking about James, the first thing I did when I went to Southampton was the culture was to, I think, meet up and have a kind of social afternoon on a Sunday. That got stopped because I found out where they were drinking. And I went around me and my wife. You probably know the places better than me. And I walked in there. It was a Thursday, and I said, "Can I speak to the manager?" "Manager, yeah." I says, "Are the boys coming?" "Ah, he was quite proud, yeah." I says, "Do us a favour, don't let them in here again, because you're just killing their career." And letters will be sitting in the car, and the boys just looked at me. "I'm serious." I said, "You want to make them good football players? Or you can make them drunks if you want." "Oh, right." And then I just go back in the car. I can't remember the guy's name. It was one of these places on a Sunday, everybody went drinking in Southampton. It was in the city centre. I found out everywhere they were drinking.
Because he said a footballer's prerogative is to moan. That's from James Beattie himself. But he realises that once everything you were doing in terms of their fitness, driving them further than they wanted to go sometimes, the why, you always gave them the why, this is why we're doing it. And then they realised it themselves, that they're fitter and stronger as a player.
Funny enough, yeah, we did that. We got fit. And the belief, because of the unfittest team I've seen, when I first got there. And then after about a year and a half, they believed they were the fittest team in the league. They weren't scared of anybody fitness-wise. Seriously, not at all. No matter what age they were, whether it be 19 or 31, they generally thought they were, which are great results. Beat Chelsea away, Liverpool away, beating Liverpool again. Tottenham, we battered Tottenham 5. Then we played them next again week, beat them 1. But Glenn Hoddle was the manager. So we had a right good bunch of boys. But I've got to say that they were lads that helped me become a better manager, because they were actually very honest. They come up and ask you questions. They say, why, what are you thinking about? Why did you pick that team? And why did you? Okay. Chris Martin, for instance, he was brilliant. He used to ask me some great questions. Knock on my door on a Friday, 9 o'clock at night, can I have a word with you? And ask me this. And I go, he's got a point there. You know, so they were a good bunch of lads, seriously. Dodgy and Wallow and Lundervan, Spence, what a good bunch of lads they were. Seriously good players.
I suppose that fits with their philosophy. They wanted to know. There was a hunger to learn.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you knew that. And there wasn't any there that you would think, I could do with it, you being here. Most clubs, you can get one or two of them. But that was a club that, no. I can't remember anybody being negative at all. Others who won these gregarious as other ones, you know, it was quieter ones like Marion Pahars and Fernandes, they were quieter. But within the squad, they were quite characters themselves because they were that quiet and introverted. I always remember a training session in St Andrews, and Wayne Bridge was leaving us that day. I said, "Well, you do the training." "Yeah, we're going to run on the sand dunes, or we send the Chuckle Brothers, who are the two masseurs, 100 yards out to sea, and you've got to swim round them." And Bridgie went, "Get the Chuckle Brothers in there." So the two masseurs had to swim 100 yards out, and the rest of the boys had to swim round them. And you can tell the real Marston, Beattie, they're all getting there. It's freezing, you know. And you could even see the seagulls going, nobody goes in this water. But Pahars and Fernandes are creeping into the water. You know, technically gifted players, but quite soft as such, you know. They've got it's cold. The rest of them are, yeah. And I joined and I went in the water as well and swam around the Chuckle Brothers. So that was the final training session Wayne Bridge had before he went to Chelsea.
Is there one thing that you took into your coaching and managerial experiences that you maybe would attribute to Gordon?
Again, at the time, I was impressed by him because there was so much respect between us. The principles of management will never change. To motivate somebody, whether it be individual or collective, you have to find out what makes them tick, what gets them emotional, what gets them aroused and wanting to improve and get better. And he was brilliant at that, for me personally. So that's something that I have, you know, I did at Accrington. There were lads that weren't on a lot of money. And I think my personality lends to this anyway. But I care about people, and I cared about them lads so much. And I think that came through in Gordon's. He did care, certainly for me, I'm speaking from a personal perspective, it felt like he cared about me as if he was a sort of second dad, if you know what I mean. And that sort of lends to my personality as well. And I think I still speak to some of Accrington lads now, and they still call me Gaffer. It's you know, that's nice for them. And even the lads that I've coached, I still speak to a lot of them, because I want them to live their dreams and to be the best that they can be, you know what I mean? So the relationship that a manager has or a coach has with them needs to be that. Then you can work together to improve.
One thing there, in terms of building the people around you, one thing I've always wanted to know, in terms of a manager, how easy is it to know when you're buying or getting a player in to a team? Obviously, you got better, I'd like to think, at assessing someone's talent and what they'll be able to bring to your team. How did you go about it?
I wasn't a great at, to be honest with you. I wasn't a great at. I gave myself about a 50-50% rating on that one. There is people better than me at that. And the older you get, and because, as I said to you, recruitment in Middlesbrough wasn't good. It's not the player's fault. It just wasn't their time at that place. And if I thought again, I'll listen more to Gordon McQueen when he was there. I should listen to that. But after being successful at Celtic, I thought, yeah, I know what players are. I think management's okay, coach is okay, but recruitment's a wee bit different. You know what you want, but you should, most of us should leave it to people who've got a better eye on us. That was the one thing I learned later in my career.
In terms of the team that you built around you, like Gary Pendry, particularly at Southampton, there was Dennis Roath there as well. Yeah. How important was it to have good people around you? That you was it the trust factor, the fact that they believed in the same vision goal you had, or they were just good people that wanted to learn and kind of had the same philosophies that you did?
Yeah, well, I've always went to a club and took Gary. Gary always came along with me, but I was always open to see what else was new there. You know, and at Southampton, it could easily have brought people in for Coventry, but you give them a chance. Dennis, loved his honesty, loved his work rate, same sense of humour as Gary and myself. Need that kind of connection. And David Coles was just a fantastic goalkeeping coach. It would have been very unfair if I brought my own person in somewhere and this young coach would go somewhere. So I kept him. He was brilliant. So that was decision making. But I've got to say that every day I went in the training, that I thought, this has got to be fun. And again, that's after the defeats you took, you know, by Monday, if we got a bad defeat, by Monday lunchtime would be, the humour would be back, the drive would be back, everything would be back. And that coaching staff was a fantastic coaching staff. I really enjoyed every day working with you guys. Yeah.
When you metaphorically hung up your boots and your managerial jacket, I don't know what the term for manager would be. Take off your jacket.
Join in the real world again. I don't know what you call it. Yeah, I don't know. Hanging up your madness. I don't know if you can hang up your madness or hang up your paranoia. I don't know what it is.
But you went into the world of media. Match of the day and doing that. How was that for you personally?
Yeah. I loved it at Southampton because after I left Southampton, because I was always going to take a break. I promised Les I would take a break at that point. See my contract and take a break. And I worked with Adrian Charles. We started Match of the Day too. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. But there's a thing about the media. I can work for so long and I get bored with it, really. I just get bored with it. So I'm okay. I enjoy it. I enjoy football, people. It's again what I'm talking about. When you meet a group of people and you start talking football, it's great fun. So that was the reason I did the media thing. And obviously, it helps your profile to keep you there. And there's a financial element to it as well. Nothing like football, but it's there. Saves tucking into your savings, I suppose. But it's okay, and I enjoyed working with Adrian. And then Adrian went on to ITV, and then I had some good times at ITV. But I don't yearn for it, if you know what I mean. I don't yearn for that. I do things now, like I do, I go into theatres and speak to supporters in different clubs and different places. We've done three in Edinburgh, in Scotland, in January. So I thought it was fantastic. I loved every minute of screens and showing things. No goals, just stupid moments in my career and silly things that I've done. And I thought it was a great, great period. I thought it was really good fun.
Because that's what football players miss the most, is the banter, the crack that they've had. You're part of something, and then when you retire and you move away, you haven't got that banter and crack anymore. You've got the memories, but you just need those people around you to share them.
Absolutely, and there's nothing better than sharing. When you do these things, the fans want to come along, and they don't want to hear about a goal or that, or they think they might want to hear, but you don't give them that. You tell them anecdotes that this is only them that's heard that, so it's different to them. So I cannot go along and tell jokes or something like that, because they can get them anywhere. If I tell them stories about Sir Alec Ferguson or Roy Keane or Brian Robson or Tommy Burns, that is a connection between me and them that only they've got. This connection, this story, we become closer together. And I have to thank everybody I've played with, because I use them in these times. But I only speak about people who I respect or like. You know, there's never negativity about it. I just leave that aside. Everything's great fun, because everybody wants to know who's the worst manager, who's the worst player. Oh, what was it like scoring a goal? Forget that. I'll tell you what happened after. I'll tell you what happened after the 83 Cup final, where Sir Alex killed us live on the football field. So it's all about having fun. I think that's my whole career is all about having fun. Even the day, I have to be laughing and joking as I go through the day.
It's in the book, that moment with Sir Alex after you'd won the cup. He was furious at your team for the way you performed. So anyone on the bus who said anything or laughed or joked would be a £10 fine.
Yeah, he did it at Liverpool as well when we got beat. But the thing when we did we won the cup and we won the cup in 83. And it made it look horrendous. But I looked at it for the first time, because it come on. And guess what? I get a text as I'm watching it from Sir Alex. Are you watching this? I went, it was 82 Cup final. And I went, yeah. But I'll tell you what I'm not doing. I'm not watching the 1983 Cup final. And he went, yeah. Wasn't a good day for me, that. So I text back. Because he rambled on about McLeish and Miller winning it. If it wasn't for McLeish and Miller. And it's funny when you look at it now. It was even funny the next again day. And Big Art used to say to me, have you got that medal I won you? I went, yeah, somewhere. And I told Alex. So I said, text back. He said, you didn't have the cheek to pick up a medal that day, did you? I went, I did, thanks.
I love it. You mentioned about the Strachan Academy and everything you're working on. I just wanted to get the understanding of what that involves.
It's set out 9 years ago. And I think when you firstly set out, you think, right, can we find the odd gem he's missed out in the system? And he might be in there to make him a footballer. So we started this. Then we realised, you can't find a footballer. It's fair. You're not going to find a gem. You've got maybe one or two or three can get a player at a certain level. But then we realised, we had an idea as what happened, that the education and the camaraderie of football changes these kids. The kids who leave school for different reasons, and they're not all bad kids, don't come from bad homes, don't get that. But the fact is, they're in a grey area, don't know where to go. We give them a kind of purpose and a kind of, try this and see how you get on. And these kids come to us and they kind of look you in the eye because they're not being good with people. Within a year, Mr. Strachan, how are you doing, Mrs. Strachan? Their education is fantastic. They change physically because they're training as full-time footballers. And then, so they're training in the morning, education afternoon, and vice versa. Some training, the education in the morning. So we do that, and they suddenly get fitter. They take pride in themselves. They've never worked with groups of people before, and we have to be a wee bit with demand from them. And they change. So what's happened over the last 9 years is, and this is the beauty of it, we've sent 400 kids into full-time employment. 400 into full-time employment. There's about 30 to 40 went to universities here and universities in America. And we have some in football. as footballers. We have some in football in which we give them the opportunity to do this through being an analyst, sports science and all the rest of it. So they're all doing it there. And we take people on now, talking about character. I was a kid about 3 years ago. We done it. So we do a fitness kind of thing to see how fit they are, because if they're really unfit, then it might hurt them. So it might not be for them. So I was watching this kid, and he was near the end, and he was trying to keep up with everybody. And at the end, he collapsed, and he was rolling about. And I thought, he's never going to be a footballer, but let's bring him along, because what a character he's got. Last year he went Derby University to study journalism, just for this driving character. So when you started with the football, people think, oh, he's trying to produce footballers. No, I'm trying to produce young men to give them a chance. And if football's your way, journalism, sports science, whatever. You know, people are going into accountancies and things like that. But they've had this character building thing as well, because we demand from them. And then they take off and hopefully be successful in life. So that's what it's doing. As a non-profit organisation, matter of fact, it's the reverse of a non-profit organisation. I'm glad we keep it going. And due to myself and my friends who keep propping it up at times, that's for sure.
Well, it sounds like a great achievement that you get to see these people and know that you're doing kind of what you did with your managing as well, is bring the best out of people. People always want to know in every interview with a manager, a football player or sports personality, whatever it is, they always want to know what's the greatest achievement that you've had. I, from reading the book, I know that your marriage to Leslie has been there through every step of the way. Your three kids, Gavin, yeah, Craig and Gemma. People would normally say, my family, and been able to support me through everything. But what is it for you, Gordon? If you had to pick one thing that you're very proud of.
On the professional side.
Professional side, and I suppose, you know, because I'm giving you the out by saying your family's obviously number one, but.
Yeah, I think with your family, when you look at your sons and daughters and think, well, I wish I could be like them, then you know you're all right. But on the professional, we've been so lucky, but the professional side, it probably, because most clubs are joined, it was like, okay, you've joined, let's see what we can do. There's only twice I've been asked to do things that you have to do this when you join. One was at Leeds, when Leeds were middle of the, what you call the championship now, and the chairman and the chief exec and Howard says, we have to get out of this league or the club's in trouble. So to achieve that, when something's the first time anybody's put real responsibility on me, was probably the most personal thing. There's all sorts of World Cups and European Cup finals and all the rest of it, but I think that was the one thing from a professional side. And the same thing happened to a certain extent at Celtic, but I think the Leeds was more pressure, that when they lost the league, you had to win it back. Especially going there when you knew that nobody really wanted you there. Yeah, that's probably it, really. And to be fair, as I said to you, the most successful, the most satisfying thing is I've been able to laugh for the last 50-odd years, non-stop. Usually at myself, by the way. Let's get that right.
Well, listen, Gordon, an absolute pleasure. Spoke for longer than I'd planned to with you, not because I wanted a cool time, but I just thoroughly enjoyed chatting to you and finding out about what makes Gordon Strachan tick.
Do you know the funny thing about it? It's hard to analyse yourself. It really is a dangerous thing as well to analyse yourself. I've never really sat back and go, ooh, what, just let it go. You know, that's so when people start asking me, if they go, I'm not really sure. I don't really know if I've never had a plan in my life to go anywhere. You know, I've never had an ambitious thing. You know, people have targets. I don't. I just float through it and see where I end up. Yeah. Good fun.
Amen to that. That's exactly why people remind me that I've done Radio 1, remind me I've done this or presented that. And I'm like, there was never a plan. There was just trying to enjoy the people around me and hopefully done a good job. But if I'd have set out to do something, then I'd have probably...
By the way, you set to do something like that, and if you don't do it, you think yourself as a failure. That's the problem. So that's why it's better just to go, whoa, see where we go. It's fine.
Thank you so much to my guest today, Gordon Strachan. Being in his presence for an hour, getting all that insight is just remarkable. It's a real honor. So thank you very much to him. Knowing that seeing people improve and get better is what drives him and motivates him. And with the Academy, 400 students going into employment or further education is brilliant to hear. What I would strongly suggest you do is go and check out some of his YouTube videos now. The way he's able to put down some of the journalists and protect and stand up for his players is truly remarkable. Go and check that out right now. I'd also like to thank James Beattie, my other guest, knowing how Gordon Strachan influenced his playing career and him when he was going to coach and become a manager as well is great to hear. So that's the end of the podcast for this week. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. If you'd like to stay up to date with everything, you can go to Twitter, Tom H. Deacon, very catchy title that. It's my middle name, Holmes. Yep, that's right. You found it out here first. Tom H. Deacon on Twitter or on Instagram as Tom Deacon Comedy. Really, really appreciate you coming to listen to the podcast. And hopefully in 2 weeks' time, if you keep up to date with everything, then we will catch you for the next one. I say we, it's just me and my studio here, but really looking forward to it. Until then, stay safe. See you soon.